This segment of the Financial Sense News Hour is brought to you by Nationwide Financial. For more information about Nationwide's products and services, please visit nationwide.com. That's nationwide.com. Neither Nationwide nor any of its affiliates is related to or affiliated with Jim Poplava of Poplava Securities, Incorporated.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. Our topic today is all going to be about estate planning. We'll be talking about case studies. And Kathleen, who do we have as our guest?
This week we have the so-called lawyer in blue jeans, Jeff Isaac, for us.
And Jeff, well, you'll have to hear Jeff's story, how he got that. But before we do that, we're going to be talking about some issues and actually a series of case studies today, because you're going to hear Jeff, the attorney, talk about the legal aspects of why you want to have a living trust, why you want to have wills that support it, and then also why you want to have medical directives. And every state's a little different. You don't want to get yourself in a situation where you're caught up through the probate process, or you're caught up in a situation where one spouse becomes incapacitated, becomes seriously ill, and voila, guess what? You don't have the right legal documents. Now you're talking to the courts, you're talking to judges and attorneys. So I don't want to take a little bit of the thunder from Jeff. But Kathleen, why don't we talk about a couple case studies? You've been with us about 8 years now, so you've seen a number of these things unfold over the years. Gosh, I think over 3 decades of my experience doing this, I could probably write a book on this, because we've seen some good things happen and we've seen some things that haven't worked out well. Let's talk about our first case study that we want to talk about. This happened last year where we had an individual, married, children. Unfortunately, he was an entrepreneur. He had a lot involved in businesses, in the markets, and he died suddenly of a heart attack with no estate planning documents. And why don't we discuss some of the ramifications about that, Kathleen? Because from your perspective, when somebody passes away like that, you're going to get a phone call. Somebody's going to notify us. I lost my husband. And the first thing they're going to want to know is, you know, having access to, let's say, their account, their cash, and the assets. Why don't you explain some of the problems in this case? What happens when you don't have an estate planning document and the assets are titled in one spouse only?
Well, in this particular scenario, what we had happen is we had a spouse who, naturally enough, needed some of the assets to get some estate affairs taken care of. The problem is that when you have a spouse who passes away and they don't have their other spouse listed as a beneficiary on their assets or have anyone else listed as a co-owner of the assets, for anyone to get their hands on those assets, we need at the very bare minimum a death certificate. We can't do anything until we have a death certificate and sometimes additional documentation as well. But basically, until we're able to go through the probate process, if the person died intestate, there's not a whole lot we can do. Our hands are totally tied. We're unable to help the grieving widow or the grieving widower to access those funds to pay for bills because the assets are titled in someone's name who's deceased, and we have to wait for the probate courts to grind away before we have official legal permission to move those assets into someone else's name or into the name of the estate.
Yeah, I know from an investment perspective, one of the things that we don't like to see as money managers is when we get notice from the courts, those assets are frozen. And I mean frozen. We can't change. If the stock market was going down and we wanted to get defensive, if we wanted to get something, or let's say the surviving spouse now has more of a need for income, there's nothing we can do. I mean, every single investment decision has to get approved by the court. So it's one reason why If you're listening to this program, husband and wife, single individual, you need to have some kind of documents or have some kind of legal means that gives your spouse or somebody you trust and love the access to make decisions should something unfortunately happen to yourself. And this was a case, tragically, that took a long time to resolve and is still in the process of being resolved just by virtue that it is now going to go through probate, and that can last well over a year.
So, Jim, as we've discovered over the past several years that we've been in the business, even though you may have your assets titled appropriately, you may have your assets in trust, for example, it doesn't mean that we have smooth sailing once something happens to the primary account holder or to the trustors. We've had situations come up where sibling dynamics and family dynamics have wreaked havoc with the client or the account owner's wishes for their estate.
I can think of several case studies, but I think one, Kathleen, that it's probably going to illustrate this point. We had a situation a number of years ago. Clients had both a son and a daughter. The son was very, very successful. He was a physician doing very well financially. And unfortunately, in the case of the daughter was not doing well financially. She was a mother, got divorced, had a husband that wasn't very supportive of her, and so she ended up taking care of a couple kids by herself. Now, this couple had well over seven figures, a little over $1 million plus a house that was worth a considerable amount of money, and then they had some rental property. One of the rental properties was a fourplex, and one of the ways they wanted to help their daughter out was they let the daughter live in one of the units of the fourplex. And then, of course, she returned the favor by help collecting the rents and managing the place for her parents. And one of the things their parents did in their trust is they deeded the fourplex to their daughter because, number one, she was living there. Number two, it really helped her out because she was struggling financially as a single mom. And then basically when the last spouse passed away, in this case, it was the wife, a husband passed away earlier. When she passed away, the assets outside the fourplex, in other words, the sale from the proceeds of her residence and the rest of the assets and IRAs was to be divided 50-50. Now, you would think that a brother who was doing well financially would be okay with that. He had a sister that was divorced, was struggling financially. But Kathleen, the real problem came in with the brother's wife, who was not part of the family, and said, "That's unfair. That's a valuable property, and that fourplex was worth a considerable amount of money. I forget it was $700,000 or $800,000 as a fourplex." And it was like, wait a minute. That's a good portion of the estate, and you're getting none of that. And unfortunately, to make it short, because there wasn't a clause in the trust that basically disinherits anybody that contests the outcome of the trust or the wishes of the trustees, the brother brought legal pressures against the daughter. They never went to court, but basically said, look, I want part of that. That gets included. Okay, you can keep the fourplex, but I'm going to keep more of the other assets because it's not fair that you get this amount of assets. And so, Kathleen, here was a case where a special provision could have been put in the trust that said anybody contesting the outcome or the wishes of the trustees of this trust is disinherited. So it was clear that both mom and dad wanted that property to go to their struggling daughter because their son was doing well financially, and the daughter had helped manage that property in exchange for staying there rent-free. But here it was, sibling rivalry that you would have never expected.
I'm really glad you brought up real estate, Jim, because we've had several cases where someone has passed away and portions of their estate have been in real estate or have been gifted to kids. For example, before the parents passed away, certain portions of their estate that were real estate properties or homes have been gifted to their children, but not properly documented. So all of a sudden, the mother and father pass away. Then you have real estate that you have kids that are living in those pieces of real estate that all of a sudden become part of the estate or have to be conveyed into the estate, and all kinds of craziness starts to happen with the siblings and with all these different pieces of property. So I'm really glad you brought up real estate, because that can be a really messy situation if the parents haven't taken care of that and properly documented any gifts ahead of time.
And there's another couple of things that come into play here, too. If you put property in, let's say, joint tenancy with children, a lot of parents will do that because they thought, well, this is an easy way to do estate planning. When something happens to me, it goes to this kid or my children. You don't realize the minute that you put them in joint tenancy with your kids, you've made a gift and you're required to file a gift tax return. That's number one. If you live in a community property state like California, Nevada, Arizona, what happens when a spouse passes away is that the value of the property gets stepped up to market value. So basically, you are allowed to turn around and sell that property and you would have no capital gains. So you lose the stepped up basis in cost. And also, here's another one, and we don't have time to talk about some of the tragedies that occur when this happens. But let's say that you're a spouse and you put property in joint tenancy with your children. All of a sudden, that child gets in a car accident, that child gets sued. Your assets are subject to the claims of the creditors. So there's all kinds of things that can come into play from government, loss of tax benefits, creditors coming into play.
And let's not forget elder abuse. If you title assets jointly with your children, you'd like to think you can trust your kids, but we've had situations where parents have titled their assets jointly with their children or made their children co-trustees with them, and the kids started to siphon off assets. So again, approach those situations with care, and like you said, take into account the possible tax consequences. And also, if you are planning on having, let's just say that you have your oldest child is really responsible. You want them to be in charge of the estate after you pass away. And you think, oh, the easiest way for Sally to be responsible for all these assets is to make her joint owner. And then when I pass away, she can split all those assets among the kids. Well, she's not in any way obligated to do that. Sally just basically inherited your entire estate, has no obligation to split those assets among the family members.
And just hope Sally's getting along with everybody else.
Exactly.
I want to talk about another case here. Now, you're going to hear in a moment when I begin my interview with Jeff Isaac, I want to talk about corporate trustees, because what we've seen over and over again over the years, this happens a lot in marriages where one spouse handles the finances and the other spouse doesn't. In most cases, it's usually the husband. All of a sudden, husband passes away, wife is surviving spouse. There's significant assets that are involved here. And also there might be proceeds that come in from life insurance. And let's say that spouse is not equipped to make financial decisions. So husbands, if you're listening to this, or a wife listening to this, this may be something that impacts you directly in the sense that having a corporate trustee that is not only going to protect those assets, know how to handle those assets, how to invest them to meet your income goals, whatever your individual needs are, that's one issue that you have to deal with. But another one is protecting you should you remarry. I've seen a number of cases. In fact, we had a case a number of years ago where one of our clients lost her husband and she had some life insurance proceeds. She was keeping them in the bank and she met somebody through their club. And he was suggesting at that time, interest rates were much higher back then. This was before the financial crisis. But he was suggesting that they combine their assets together. In other words, she help him out because by combining their assets in a joint account, they could get a jumbo CD, which paid a higher interest rate. So you want to be careful of a Don Juan that comes along. You want to be careful, even in the case of a second marriage, that you keep those assets separate so you don't commingle them, because that just creates a whole big nightmare with both families on both sides. And so there's another reason to have a corporate trustee, and this is really to protect a surviving spouse for a number of reasons. Number one, protect against commingling of assets, protect against a Don Juan coming along, protect against elder abuse. And those are just three that come to mind, Kathleen.
Jim, so far we've sort of talked about situations in families and estates that are pretty straightforward. But there are situations in which there are other reasons to use a corporate trustee. Let's just say you have a multi-million dollar estate, for example, that's subject to all kinds of special tax situations, or maybe you have multiple properties in the family, or you have a business that you own with your family, or you own it yourself. If you have a complex situation like that, to ask a family member or a friend to act as trustee of that kind of an estate is really placing a huge burden on that person. Usually to administer that type of an estate can take years. Lots of time, lots of tax filings, lots of appraisals, lots of dealing with family dynamics. So another reason to use a corporate trustee is to kind of bypass the family dynamics and also to remove a burden of responsibility off of a loved one's shoulders, because it can take a lot of time and energy to administer a trust. Unfortunately, over the years, Jim, we've seen several situations where the family dynamics really became the crux of the problems with the estate. We have had situations in which certain children were granted responsibility to be the executor of the estate or to be the administrator of the trust, and all sorts of complicated family dynamics, sibling dynamics started to raise their heads. You have situations where maybe your children are trustworthy, but perhaps their spouses aren't so much, or you have a child who's been through multiple marriages or multiple relationships, and you have all these complicated family dynamics. And if you think that your family dynamics are complicated now, you add money, especially a lot of money, into the mix, and all those problems just get magnified exponentially when someone passes away and they have a complicated estate. So again, one of the main reasons why you want to use a corporate trustee is if you have a complicated estate, or maybe you have a really complicated family dynamic. So those are two good reasons to look for a corporate trustee. I think one of the main problems we've discovered with our clients when it comes to estate planning and titling of assets is that no one wants to think that they're going to pass away. And so they don't necessarily want to do that planning right now. They keep putting it off and putting it off and putting it off. And I know, Jim, as you and I were sort of talking about the types of stories we wanted to discuss today, you actually discussed what happened with your dad when he was sick and he was in the hospital. Would you mind sharing with our listeners the story you shared with me as far as what happened with your dad and his estate when he got ill?
I lost my father to lung cancer back in 1989. And I had been in the business, as I mentioned to you, Kathleen, I had been in the business about 10 years. I was a certified financial planner. In my parents being European, buying real estate was something that my dad understood, my mom understood. And I come from a family of 10 kids, and they had 9 pieces of property. And they never got quite up to 10 before Dad passed away. And my parents' thinking was, we'll have 10 properties, and when we pass on, each one of our kids will have a piece of property. And they mainly bought residential real estate. And so as I became a certified financial planner, understood estate taxes, probate, and all the issues that we have to deal with today with complexity in administering estates, I kept telling my parents, because they basically kept things in joint tenancy. And my mother, God bless her, she was a little stubborn, said, well, we got things in joint tenancy. And I said, you know, Mom, Dad, you really need to do something more than this. And Kathleen, back then, the exemption on estates were only $600,000. So the value of my parents' property was above $600,000. So if something happened to both my parents, I tried to explain to them there could be estate taxes. So all these properties they thought they were going to hand out to the kids.
Oh, and probate on 10 properties. Can you imagine how crazy that would have been and how long that would have taken to administer 9 properties in probate? That's a lot of property to put through probate.
Oh, it would have been absolutely crazy. The one thing I was able to do was get insurance policies because, you know, back then they didn't have a trust. And I said, you know, there could be estate taxes. You don't know, you know, your mom and dad could be driving on the road and get on the wrong freeway. And so to make a long story short, almost an entire decade. And then in August of 1989, my dad was diagnosed with lung cancer. And to make a long story short, all of a sudden the need to do estate planning became real. And Kathleen, I can remember the last week of my father's life where we had a state attorney that was brought in doing the estate planning. And as you know, Kathleen, it's not just the fact that you have to have a trust. You have to convey the properties to the trust so the trust owns them to avoid probate. And we were literally literally in the last week of my father's life, getting estate planning documents signed in the hospital, getting deeds on the property conveyed over to the trust. And we were doing this the last 5 days when he was alive in the hospital. Instead of spending time, we were overburdening my dad with all these legal decisions, documents that had to be signed, couriers to the hospital, back and forth, provisions, changes. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but that was one of the memories I have. Final memories of my dad was this hectic period of getting this done. We started it basically a month before he passed away. They thought he was going to live a lot longer than he did. He just didn't handle the chemo very well and took him suddenly. But here was a situation that was brought home and made real and done at the last minute. And I'll tell you, Kathleen, that's not exactly what you want to be doing if you're losing a spouse, you know, the grieving process, or you have a spouse that becomes incapacitated. These aren't the things that you want to be dealing with. You want to be dealing with, you know, making sure they're comforted, they're loved, and spending those final moments that are so dear to you, rather than dealing with the lawyers, judges, and the court system. It just isn't fun.
Well, like you were mentioning, Jim, the whole point of this estate planning really is to make things easier for those that you leave behind. And like you were saying, if you leave it to the last minute, then those last moments of your life are spent with these very dry legal problems instead of really enjoying your last time with your family. And once you have passed, if you haven't done a good job with your estate planning, you're burdening your family with a lot of time in probate court, a lot of time wrangling with each other. And so it's really a big gift to your family to do a good estate plan well in advance of anything happening to you or you getting ill. Because the other thing is too, Jim, when you're either approaching your final days or you're someone whose spouse or loved one has just passed away, you're not really in any good shape to make any really decent financial decisions. So what you want to do is make sure that you yourself are in a strong place to make those financial choices now for your family and your estate, so that when something happens to you, those left behind aren't burdened with making those decisions either, and they can focus on the grieving process and focus on the necessities of life that need to get done after someone passes away, instead of dealing with reams and reams of paperwork and time in court. So it's really a gift to your family to do good planning.
And there's another benefit. One of the things that you can benefit from, not only avoiding all these issues we just talked about, but also avoiding estate taxes, because right now the exemption is a little over $5 million. So between a husband and wife, you can pass $10 million with no estate taxes. After that, those tax rates can get up to 40%. In the case of my parents, there was an additional benefit. I talked about community property estates and the stepped-up basis and cost. Now, a lot of these properties that my parents owned were fully depreciated at the time of my father's death. But because Arizona being a community property state, Kathleen, not only did the properties get stepped up to their market value at my dad's death, but by putting those properties away in a trust, we were able to exclude at that time $600,000 from estate taxes. And those properties have continued to grow in value, so they're worth more. And in addition to that, my mother got to redepreciate those properties, not at what she originally bought them for, but at the market value at the time of my dad's death. Basically, you can assess value on property at date of death or 9 months later. And so it worked out advantageously, not only from an estate tax point of view, but it also helped my mother on the income tax point of view.
Jim, just kind of wrap up. I know that we've been doing a lot more financial planning recently than we have for a long time. And I've noticed that one of the things that we tend to do for the people that come in to talk to you about their financial planning is we do a review of their estate documents and their estate plan. Now, again, we're not estate attorneys, but we are able to look at the estate plan documents and the strategy that the couple or the family or the individual has and say, you know what, based on your assets, based on your goals for your assets once you pass away, here are a few suggestions we have for you as far as things you should consider discussing with an estate attorney. You know, oftentimes people ask us for an estate attorney referral, and we do have some people we work with in the local area here that we really like. But again, we just really encourage people to not only create an estate plan, but to review it every couple, 3 years, since estate law is always changing. As we've been discussing, Jim, we have been doing some more financial planning and some more feedback for people for their estate plan. So if you're interested in talking to us about your financial planning or perhaps looking over what's going on with your estate plan, Jim, what's the best way for folks that listen to reach us?
Well, we make that real easy. We have a toll-free number, 888-486-3939.
Thanks so much, Jim. Before we forget, coming up next, Jim is going to be interviewing Jeff Isaac, the lawyer in blue jeans, to show you how to do it right. We've been talking a lot about the quote-unquote horror stories of bad estate planning, so stay tuned to hear about how to do it the right way with Jeff Isaac and Jim, coming up next.
Joining me on the program today is Jeff Isaac. He's a lawyer from the Lawyer in Blue Jeans Group, and Jeff specializes in revocable living trust and probate administration. Jeff, just out of curiosity, you're a local celebrity here. You have your own radio show. You're on the news. But out of curiosity, where's the Lawyer in Blue Jeans come from?
First of all, good to be here. I thoroughly enjoy doing what I do, and I've been a lawyer a long time. Well, I started out real quickly to make it as quick as I can. I've been a lawyer for going on four decades, and the first half of my training and my law career was more formal. I wore the three-piece suits. I was a reactive lawyer. I did 2,000 divorces. I did some drunk drivings and bankruptcies, and anybody had a problem, I was there to solve it, and it got old real fast. So when I started doing radio and television, or proactive stuff, with hence what I planning. But on my radio show one day, we were sitting there, and we were called the Legal Assist Live. That was, you know, boring, crazy name for my show. And we were going in and out of the programming with bumper music in between commercials, and Neil Diamond has to be one of the guys. So Forever in Blue Jeans got played every once in a while, and all of a sudden I found myself referring to me, as well as my listeners to me, as the lawyer in blue jeans, and it just stuck. And the first time or three times I said it, it was like, that's weird. But now, unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, my uniform of the day is blue jeans, and virtually everywhere I go, that's what I'm wearing. And it's more really the concept of the philosophy of law, and that is, let's talk common sense, let's talk English. We have 500,000 new laws every year. We have 2 million new regulations every year. We have 11 lawsuits filed every minute in the state of California. Sometimes we just need some proactivity and common sense, and that's what I kind of like to have the blue jeans reflect as my feelings about law.
Well, let's get into estate planning. We seem to have dodged a bullet with the fiscal cliff. They raised the tax rates from 35 to 40%, but they left that exemption at $5 million. And one of the comments that I get, Jeff, oh, it's $5 million, so, you know, I don't need any estate planning because I don't have any taxes. Let's talk about the problems of that.
Well, it is a problem, and you can call whatever you want to be taxes. I mean, the good news is that it started out, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars, and everything over that was 55%. And if the fiscal cliff thing was not resolved a few weeks ago, it would have gone down to $1 million exemption and another up to 55% estate tax, which would have been a killer. You know, excuse the pun. It would have been really bad news. So it's gone back to the $5 million that Obama agreed to a couple of years ago, and that's now permanent. So that's great. So we got a $5 million exemption. If you're married, that's double that. And actually, it's a little bit more. It's about, instead of $10 million, it's about $10.24 million with the cost of living stuff that they threw in there. So there's no estate tax unless you have more than that. And then it starts at that level, by the way, with the difference. So that's good. But what's not good is people thinking that, okay, now I can sit on my hands, and I don't need a will, I don't need a trust, I'm good. Well, you're not good, because when you have nothing, it's called intestacy, and you're going to probate, and you're letting the government make all the decisions. And if you have a little will, you're still going to probate. You might have a little control, but the government and the attorneys are going to suck the money out of you because it's expensive and it takes forever. So you do need to do something unless you've got nothing. Now, if you got nothing, it may not make a big difference. But if you've got any money or property, especially in the state of California, you're going to go to probate, and the government and attorneys will bounce you around. And the end result is you may not pay estate tax, but you're going to be paying what a lot of people still would call a tax, and that's probate fees, and that gets real expensive, burdensome, and the good news is it's unnecessary.
Jeff, talk about some of the burdens and how assets could be, let's say, tied up in court. You might have to get permission from a probate judge to have access to it. Talk about the hassles, because I don't think people are aware how long it takes to settle an estate when you're going through the probate process, dealing with attorneys, as you mentioned. They're sucking you dry for fees. The court are involved in there. This is a nightmare at a time where a spouse may be grieving for the loss of his or her spouse. That's not what you want to be dealing with when you lose a spouse.
No, you got enough problems when you lose a spouse or a loved one, and that's the emotional part, and law can't do much for you, except what we can do is not pile on. And what happens is when you don't have the proper documents, or in this case, let's say a revocable trust, you're going to get piled on by lawyers and the government. It's just part of the game. And I personally think that it's a bureaucracy that is totally unnecessary. Most people want to be in full control. They don't want to have the government involved in things they don't need to be. I mean, face it, here's the bottom line, Jim. What's the situation? I mean, do you really think that we're so stupid that we don't have the ability to know who we're giving our stuff to when we die? Do we need the government to help us? And by the way, charge us a fortune and take years to take care of? I mean, those are the questions you want to ask yourself, and a lot of people don't realize that that will come into play in most cases. Now, the other thing is that you're sitting on a situation where you want to have control, but you're not going to get it by osmosis. It's just not going to happen unless you actually go out there and prepare a set of documents or have them prepared for you most reasonably. And then it does play right into it, because it not only works upon death, but the trust itself works upon incapacity to avoid conservatorships, which could cost several thousands of dollars in legal fees. And people love to knock the government, but the reality is why not be proactive and make sure you've got your stuff together, you got your ducks in a row? It's not that hard. It's really not that expensive compared to what the alternative is. And by the way, when you go into probate, meaning that you die and you've got assets or you've got property, everything is frozen. The government freezes your assets, your bank account. You can't sell the house. You can't refinance the house. You can't sell the stock. You can't do anything until they say green light. And that could take a year or two, or it could take 20. And I've seen 20-year probates. It's scary stuff.
Let's talk about a will for a moment, because there's this perception, oh, I got a will. We got those, and I don't have to worry about this. Let's talk about what a will does, the advantages of a will, but also let's talk about, Jeff, what it doesn't accomplish.
Yeah, well, wills are good for maybe people who have no money or people who don't care what happens to them. I guess, you know, you could say, you know, you probably don't even need a will because they don't care. They say, when I'm dead, I'm dead. Who cares? And that's not a prevalent opinion. Obviously, I think most people do care. But wills are old-fashioned. Wills basically say, I want my kids or my wife or somebody to get so-and-so or get so many items or whatever it might be. But wills, you've heard of the term probate a will. Well, that tells it all right there. A will must be probated. That's what we want to avoid, because probate is nothing but government and attorneys saying, you're stupid, we're going to take care of things for you, and by the way, you know, step out of the way because it's going to cost you some money. So wills only work upon death, and they will be probated. A trust works upon death, avoids all probate, and works upon incapacity. I mean, the good news, Jim, as you know, the good news is we're living longer. And the bad news is we're living longer, and doctors are having trouble keeping up with us, with Alzheimer's at all-time high and dementia and strokes and things like that. It'd be nice to have control, and everything keeps coming back to that. You be in control, not the government. So wills are antiquated, in my opinion. There's a place for them in some situations. You get a special will with a trust, and that's only a safety valve. But a will to be relied on solely as the instrument that's going to take care of your world is not the way to go. It's not the proper way.
Let's also talk about another living risk between both spouses, Jeff, that you raised, and that is, okay, we know there's all kinds of hassles when somebody passes away if you don't have a trust. You've got people, lawyers, courts, assets are frozen, time consuming. You can't make decisions. Only the court can make those and give you the go ahead. But another issue that is raised, and we're seeing it more, as you just mentioned, is because we're living longer. So you're seeing cases of Alzheimer's. You're seeing cases of dementia. Talk about what are the documents that are needed there, because the will doesn't help you there as well.
No, will doesn't. And to be honest with you, a trust can be of some significant help, but there's not absolute. And the bottom line is you've got to execute these documents, whatever they may be, while you still have capacity. Because if you don't have capacity, the documents are going to be void or they're not going to work. So you've got to have the ability to make good decisions or at least know what you're doing. And that's going to be critical before you can execute these documents. There are things that we put in revocable trust that help people deal with the eventuality if you have dementia or Alzheimer's, where you have incapacity, and those are your powers of attorney, advanced health care directives. And these are not stuff that you can just hand write. You've got to conform to the state's specifics as to what the regulations are. So it's in California, for instance, there was a thing called a power of attorney for health care. No longer there. They made it illegal in the early 2000s. It's now called an advanced health care directive. So hospitals can wiggle out of using these things and just say the word no. No, I'm not going to use it. Go get me a court. Go get me a judge to sign off. You never want to hear that, because when you hear that, you got to go to a lawyer. You got to petition the court, go in front of the court. That's all money. That's green money and time wasted. And so the Advanced Health Care Directive, the power of attorney, durable power of attorney for finances are really kind of brothers and sisters to the legal document of the trust. And when you have all of these together, and they're not that hard, they're not that complicated, but when you have them all together, now you've got an estate plan that says, I am going to continue having control of my stuff. I'm not going to let Uncle Sam be involved. There will be no court hearings. And everybody, by the way, is going to get along because they have to. The rules are set. A lot of people lose sight, and most people think, you know, my kids are not going to be a problem. Everybody is going to get along just fine. There'll be no greed. There'll be no contest. And in all the years I've done this, I can tell you that, wow, you know, when people die and there's money involved, sometimes you see stuff that just blows your mind as to people's greed. And when you put a trust together or you put an advanced care health care directive together, it takes a lot of that uncertainty and that potentiality of your family breaking up, because that's what happens when they fight, away, because you're putting down what you want, and to fight or defeat a trust is very difficult. And that's an element a lot of people don't talk about, how it really keeps the family cohesive and coherent rather than where people start fighting and shooting darts at each other.
Jeff, you and I could probably write books. I've seen this in over 30 years. It is amazing. I had a situation where, you know, they had mom died at 11:30. They were taking her to the morgue, and the kids were in the office at 12 o'clock, and already there was a feud in terms of how the money was going to be split, who was going to get what. Oh, my goodness.
And you can't put words or money on the description of that, as you know, Dan. It's not something you can really even forecast. I mean, sometimes you know you've got problems with kids, but the reality is you never really know until it comes down to it. And this just makes sure it's all good.
And never forget about the daughter-in-law or the son-in-law. They can always add an interesting element when money is involved. Jeff, I know there's different laws in the country. We have dower states, curtsy states, you know, Arizona and California, where you and I live, are community property states. Do trust work in all the states of the country? In other words, if you're a dower state, curtsy, can you explain? Do they work?
And Jim, the way this works is that there's a thing called full faith and credit. And I don't want to get fancy with people with legal terms, but it's a constitutional right that if something is good in one state, basically it's good in all states. And so you get a California trust, it will be honored to its full faith and credit in Georgia, in South Carolina, in Florida, in New York, in Madison, you know, so it does work. Now, there are state-specific issues that sometimes you want to update in those specific states if you do move, but a trust done in one state will be recognized in all their states. So when I tell people about trust, people go like, wow, it almost sounds too good to be true. Guess what? This is one of those exceptions to that rule. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. This thing works. There's almost virtually no downside by having a trust. It's all good. And so it can be used anywhere in the United States, any property in the United States or its territories. It doesn't work for European properties or foreign properties because they have to have their own, you know, rules. But you can move anywhere in the world and it will work for any property in the United States. And so it's all good. It's one of the few things the government has given us to kind of beat them at their own game. And I like that.
And so as we take a look at this, in summary, number one, if you have a trust, you're going to avoid probate. So if either spouse passes away, you're not going to have to go through the courts. You're going to be able to make investment decisions, carry on the affairs just as both spouses are living. That's number one. Number two, if you do happen to have large assets, let's say if you're over $5 million, it allows you to double your exemption and raise that $5 million to over $10 million. So number two, you're going to avoid estate taxes. It can also help in dealing with issues of incapacity. Number four, it could also help dealing with issues of family feud over money, who gets what, arguments of various matters. Jeff, why do you think so many people don't use it? Because I'm in the business of financial planning, you know, I insist on it because I know the nightmare of managing money, what happens if all of a sudden we're in probate and all of a sudden now the judge says, oh, assets are frozen.
Yep.
Jim, you can't make a doggone decision. Doesn't matter if the market's going down or the surviving spouse needs income. We got to wait for the judge. Why do you think people don't deal with it? Is it the issue of death and mortality? In other words, like it's Friday night, you're sitting around, probably the last thing you're thinking about is your estate plan.
That's part of it. I think part of the P word comes into play a lot, procrastination. If there's anything in the world you could procrastinate on, it would be this. And people go like, one of these days, I'll do it. You know, that's A. And unfortunately, someday we're going to die tomorrow. We just don't know what tomorrow it's going to be. And so it could be too late. I mean, if I had a dollar for every client that said, boy, have I been putting this off, but here I am. Now, why are they here? Well, sometimes they're triggered by the fact that maybe they have an illness that they have to go in for surgery, or they're going on a vacation and they're scared. So little things can trigger these things. Unfortunately, not enough people say, gee, I just should do this and I'll have peace of mind, because it does give you that. The other reason that people don't do it, in my opinion and my experience, is that they don't realize how impacting probate can be. Unless you go through it, unless you really have the education of what a probate is, people don't realize how bad it is, and so they don't know that there is a way to avoid that. You know, a lot of people just trust the government. They just trust that it's going to be okay, or they're stubborn. I get a lot of East Coast people. My dad was from East Coast, so I know. They're stubborn, and they go, hey, I don't need to trust. I'm good. I'm good. You guys are going to be fine. No, you're not. You're not going to be fine. You're going to go through a lot of garbage that you don't have to go through. And I should say one more thing that hasn't been stated, and that is not any trust works. I would not sit out there and tell people to just write your own trust, or necessarily go to somebody who doesn't know what they're doing, or even a general attorney, let alone a paralegal, and have one done off the cuff. You need to have it done right, because there are things in there, at least in California, with Medi-Cal protection and HIPAA protection and things in there that really need to be put in on a custom basis. Because if you go to one of these agencies or you do the do-it-yourself trust, it can be a situation where you go like, hey, I'm protected, I'm good. And then you die and the spouse goes, okay, we have a trust, and then find out that it doesn't work. That would be a bad surprise. So do it right if you're going to do it at all. And then most of this stuff legally just goes away. It's just really one of those great, great proactive things in law. Very seldom do we see it, but this is one.
Jeff, what about a corporate trustee? Now, during a couple's lifetime, both husband and wife can be co-trustees to the estate. So if one of them dies or becomes incapacitated, one of the issues we've been running up against, and I don't know if you're seeing this in your practice, it's become more prominent in the last, probably more in the last decade or so, where you were using corporate trustees because, number one, a lot of times the kids are in different states. Number two, they don't have the time for administration. And I'm talking about, let's say, when the final spouse passes away, or you're dealing with a case where there's one surviving spouse, but that surviving spouse gets dementia. What about using a corporate trustee? In other words, to keep everything on neutral ground and keep the boxing match or fighting that often comes in when, you know, large amounts of money are involved. You've got son-in-laws, daughter-in-laws. Everybody wants a piece of the pie. What about corporate trustees?
Well, my general feeling is if you're not a big fan, they charge a lot more money and they can become a problem only because they're so ultra conservative that you can't move. It's like a mini Uncle Sam. If that's your only alternative, then fine. You know, do what you can do. If you don't have any family, you don't have any friends, you don't have any accountants that will pick it up. I personally do not do trustee work for my clients. I think, number one, it's a conflict of interest. And number two, I'm just too busy for it. I just don't have time. But I encourage my clients to just see if you can get, you can have a family member as long as that person is organized and got their act together, or you can have a next door neighbor or an aunt or uncle or an accountant or somebody that's just got a little business sense. And you can pay them or not pay them. It's up to you. And you do want to check with them because you don't want somebody to bow out because they just don't have the time. So my overall summary would be I'm not a big fan of corporate trustees unless you have to. But if that's the only alternative, it's certainly better than government be your trustee because they will appoint somebody as an administrator or executor. And then it becomes a problem if you don't have a trust.
Jeff, a final question. What about elder abuse and what can individuals do to avoid it?
Well, you know, how many hours do we have? You know, it's sad because it is somewhat of a prominent kind of thing that we see in today's world. And certainly you want to take all avenues to kind of make sure dad and mom or grandparents are being taken care of wherever they are, whether it be a rest home, by kids, I mean, by siblings. There's a lot of pressure sometimes that people will push and commit this kind of thing. It's a criminal act. It's a tortuous act, and that means civil wrong. It's a bad thing. And certainly if you care about your parents or care about the possibility of that happening, you've got to keep your eyes open and you've got to watch it. There are some great organizations out there that you can go to that watch over this stuff. All I can say, common sense is really the most important thing on this. You know, parents, when they age or when people get up there in age, they just can't make good decisions sometimes, or dementia, things like that. And so you've got to take the proper steps. And rest homes particularly, nursing homes, you better do some shopping before you put your loved one in a nursing home, because there's probably, I hate to say this, there's probably more bad than good out there, and you really want to do your diligence to make sure that your eyeballs are on top of the whole thing.
Jeff, if our listeners, especially those in California, would like to contact you for advice, how could they do so?
Real simple. Just go to lawyerinbluejeans.com. That's as easy as that, lawyerinbluejeans with an S, .com, and you can shoot me an email or give us a call at the office. Our 800 number is 1-800-8-IMPACT, I-M-P-A-C-T. And we usually do free consultations and happy to talk to anybody about a variety of things that I do on radio and TV and here in the office.
All right. We've been speaking with Jeff Isaac, the lawyer in blue jeans. Jeff, I want to thank you for joining us on the Financial Sense News Hour. Thanks, and please come back and speak with us again.
Hey, my pleasure. It was fun.
And don't forget, if you missed it last week, we did a special segment on tax strategizing for the rich and famous, where we took a look at Phil Mickelson's tax situation and talked about defined benefit plans. And stay tuned next week when Jim's going to be talking about brain health with Dr. Gary Small, who happens to be the director of UCLA's Longevity Center. So stay tuned for those two programs.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.
This segment of the Financial Sense News Hour is brought to you by Nationwide Financial. For more information about Nationwide's products and services, please visit nationwide.com. That's nationwide.com. Neither Nationwide nor any of its affiliates is related to or affiliated with Jim Poplava of Poplava Securities, Incorporated.